worker over the years and being a part of the Teamsters Union and an advocate of Teamsters for a Democratic Union, as well as a Green Party candidate in Democrat-controlled New York, especially upper state New York. 20 years ago, the North American Free Trade Agreement was passed, and boy howdy has it sucked. In that same year, 1994, the Zapatista Army of National Liberation was formed, espousing a revolutionary mix of indigenous rights, feminism, and anarchism, as well as socialism. The Zapatistas have been in a declared war with the Mexican state since then. Well Read Red, Fran Michel, looks at how this conflict is being remembered, fought, and supported today. In the second half of the hour, I'll read an excerpt from another one of Peter Frace's Jacobin Magazine articles about basic income, non-reformist reforms, and utopian thinking on the capitalist road to communism. It's an article titled Curious Utopias. And finally, to finish the show, Denise Morris will be talking with Yasmin Nair, a regular Old Mole guest and writer based in Chicago with the Against Equality Collective. They will be talking about queer and trans struggles in an era when the acceptance of homosexuality seems to be gaining traction, and how hate crime legislation has evolved in the wakes of several deaths, including the 20-year-ago murder of Brandon Tina, a trans man. And they'll be focusing on how the economic, racial, and sexual inequalities that prevail in these times perpetuate quote-unquote hate-based violence, and how they may be underlooked in the way that that legislation is brought to the public. But you are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on 90.7 FM in Portland. I am your host, Joe Clement. We are now just going to jump right in with Bill Resnick and Howie Hawkins.
Howie Hawkins, welcome to KABU.
Good to be here.
Howie Hawkins is a worker, organizer, a writer, a speaker. He co-founded the Clamshell Alliance, one of the early anti-nuclear groups. He also co-founded the U.S. Green Party. He's been a candidate for governor and the Senate for the Green Party in the state of New York, and he, in one of his, I guess, his most recent elections, I write, Howie, you got 60,000 votes, which kept the Green Party on the ballot in New York City. He's also a candidate for mayor and also city council of Syracuse, New York. He came very near winning several times as a Green. Howie's made a living as a Teamster working the night shift at UPS as a temp worker. He lives in the Syracuse area. He does local politics there. Howie, you've been at UPS for 13 years. Tell us about the UPS model for pacifying workers and their program of speed up and cutting wages.
Well, starting in the 70s, they started having people that handle packages, which is both unloading the trucks, sorting the packages, and loading the trucks, work part-time, which enabled them to, you know, work people a lot faster, because after 3.5-4 hours of moving a package every 3 or 4 seconds, packages that go up to 150 pounds, most people are pretty exhausted at that point. And so that's how they sped things up. They also, in 1982, got a differential between full-time and part-time wage scales.
They got the differential in a union contract.
Right, in 1982, when, you know, Fitzsimmons was in there, the mob controlled a lot of locals, and it wasn't really the workers' organization. And through an effort through the Teamsters for a Democratic Union, they finally got a federal takeover that did some cleanup of the mobbed-up locals and got direct election of the union president, which led to a man named Kerry being union president and a strike in 97, which got us the best contract we got since, you know, in decades. And we're still benefiting from that, although we've had some pullback under the Hoffa regime. There was a scandal, some sort of mid-level people in the Clinton administration and the Kerry administration had a kickback scheme where people contribute to the Teamsters, and then the Teamsters promised to contribute to the Democratic National Committee. And Kerry actually got exonerated. He's passed on now, but he got barred for life from the union because of that in the initial ruling. So that's how James Hoffa Jr. got in there. He hasn't really fought for us in the contract negotiations with UPS, in my opinion.
You're a part-time worker, right? You won a significant contract victory that Hoffa has completely ignored.
Well, the big thing in 97 was the slogan. We had a two-week strike, and basically UPS caved right away because customers started switching shipping companies. And the slogan was, part-time America doesn't work. So we got 10,000 new full-time jobs where they combined two part-time jobs inside the hubs. But that part of the contract really hasn't been implemented, and that's a big issue because in my hub, there are people that worked there 17 years. They still don't have enough seniority to apply for openings of full-time when full-time workers retire, and they aren't adding full-time these combo jobs. So that's an issue. So we have what we call full-time part-timers because a lot of guys, they got to work two part-time shifts to make ends meet, but they're getting a lower wage scale. There's about a $6 differential between the part-time wage scale and the full-time wage scale. So we got people that are still doing that 8 hours of or more of moving packages at the faster rate that, you know, 30 years ago the company said would kill people. It's tough. You know, people working those shifts, coming in, we call it a twilight shift and then a night shift, and they get there at 5 o'clock. They don't leave till 3 or 4 in the morning, and it's physically very demanding. And they're getting a part-time scale.
Although, unlike most companies, UPS is still a dream company to work for in that there's a defined benefit pension, as small as it might be because of wages. And wages are somewhat higher than the minimum wage, even the starting wages. Am I wrong about that? Even the starting wage?
The starting wage has been very low. In 1982, when they started differentiating full-time and part-time scales, the starting wage was $8 an hour. Right now, it's $8.50 an hour. That's starting. Now, you get a raise every year in the contract that's going to be ratified, hopefully pretty soon, 70 cents an hour raise across all the scales a year for the next 5 years. And that's the first 3 years, and then it's a little more the last 2 years of that contract. So you get a raise. The pensions vary on the region because they're regional pension funds. And the one we got in upstate New York is one of the better ones, and we get a decent pension. The Central States Pension Fund, they've had a lot of problems, and they've had cutbacks. We've had cutbacks. I mean, the accrual rate when I started was 2.5%, and then after 9/11, they lowered it to 1.5%, and then after 2008, they lowered it to 0.5%. So the pension that I thought I was going to get keeps getting cut back, but it's still decent for compared to everybody else. So we do have defined benefit, which is unusual today, and we got a good health plan in my region, upstate New York. Now, right now, the UPS contract, there's supplements, regional supplements. The national contract barely passed 53% to 47%, but 19 of the regional supplements or local supplements were voted down. Now, the company made changes, and most of them got passed. There's still six outstanding or so. That had mostly to do with health care because UPS wanted to put people in plans that had them paying premiums and copays, which we haven't been doing. In upstate, we don't pay any premiums. The company pays the whole thing. It's part of the whole wage package, but it doesn't come out of our pocket. And then we only have a $10 deductible on certain kinds of visits.
Does that include part-time workers as well?
Yes, it does.
That's something that's very unusual in the United States right now.
A lot of our part-timers, they work UPS for the benefits, and then they have another full-time job to, you know, get more wages.
And, of course, they wear themselves down. UPS has a huge turnover of part-timers. Some people work long, many, many, many years as a part-timer like you for 13 years, not even coming close to getting vested or being able to apply for a full-time. But a lot of people work a couple months, you know, maybe three or four times a year, and then try and go somewhere else or whatever they do.
Well, it's old-fashioned physical labor, and not everybody likes that. So we have very high turnover of the package handlers, and you don't get vested for 5 years. So, you know, I would say maybe two-thirds of the part-timers never get vested, but they pay, you know, the company pays into the pension fund about $7.50 an hour, and another $7.50 goes into health care. So you're getting maybe, when you start, $8.50, but there's another $15 that's being thrown into benefits. But most of these part-timers, and a lot of them are young people, and they don't quite get, you know, how important those benefits are. They move on. They say, oh, I can get $9 an hour at McDonald's and not break my back. So they do that. Maybe not a smart move, but that's what they do. And so a lot of the pension and health care benefits are paid for by those part-timers who never collect, you know, never use the benefits.
This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to Howie Hawkins. He's a real activist in Teamsters for a Democratic Union. He works for UPS. He's also been the Green Party candidate for both senator and governor. in New York State and has got enough votes to preserve the ballot line for the Green Party. He's extremely well known, actually, in New York and very popular. He's run for the city council and mayoralty of independent politics as a Green in Syracuse, and actually would have won if it weren't for the Working Families Party, who sent organizers into Howie's district in order to protect the Democrats. It's a sordid story, actually. But Howie never gives up. An amazing performance, Howie. You really deserve a huge amount of thanks. We've been talking about UPS, and in fact, as even though they're cutting, speeding up, using a lot of part-timers, there are benefits for people. Unlike most people in the United States right now, most workers, almost all companies, are using more part-timers. Very few of them have health benefits. The Walmartization of the U.S. is really going fairly rapidly. How did you preserve something at UPS?
Well, we got a union. We have the legacy of that strike, despite the weakness of the Hoffa regime inside the Teamsters. So we have job security. They can only fire us for just cause, not at will, like ununionized companies. And so that gives you some security, which enables you. You got a grievance procedure. When you have a union, at least you have some say. I think that's the difference between us and a comparable company in the same industry like FedEx, which, thanks to a deal they got from Reagan administration, which none of, you know, Clinton or Obama hasn't changed, although, you know, UPS and the Teamsters are together on trying to get this changed, and that is they're regulated as an airline, not a trucking company, which means if you're going to unionize FedEx, you got to do it in one big national election, not a hub-by-hub elections, which is the way the Teamsters got organized in UPS. So FedEx is kind of shielded from unionization, and you can see the difference. They sort of advertise a slightly higher wage scale, but the benefits they don't have. They don't have defined benefit pension. The 401k they got isn't much to talk about. The health care plan stinks. So it's just having a union. And even though our union could be better, having a union makes it a lot better than not having one.
Yeah, and these companies, FedEx and UPS, actually, they're, for a lot of people, they're really, really good jobs in comparison to what else is available. For one reason is because UPS and FedEx and all the delivery companies don't have one power that many, many other companies like Boeing use to their benefit and brutally against workers, which is to tell them, we're going to leave this area unless you comply with our dictates, which is what happened in the recent Boeing election when the machinists finally knuckled under in a vote to cut their health and benefit plans. And it seems to me that that capital mobility and use of part-timers is enormously injuring a great section of the American working class.
Yeah, and I think the trade agreements, they call them free trade, but it's not about trade, it's about outsourcing to other countries. My city, Syracuse, is now the second poorest city in the country after Detroit. Our poverty rate is 38% overall, 55% for children, and this is a town that used to have GE, GM, Chrysler, you name it, and all those factories have gone. And they started going in the 70s. First, they went from the city to the suburbs after World War II, like Detroit. And then from there, they went down south, and then after the NAFTA to Mexico, and after WTO to China. Carrier Corporation was a big one here. They still have a little campus here that does R&D and administration, but all the manufacturing went to China. Used to be a big multi-square-mile plant that I drive by on my way to work, and the factory, they just leveled it. It's just a flat field now. So that's the consequence of that capital mobility where they can basically blackmail workers. So you're right. The UPS can't do that because they got to be in location to deliver the packages. So we've got one of the few union jobs with a good benefit package left in the Syracuse area. The people that used to have factory and manufacturing jobs now do service for what they call the eds and meds. They are maintenance staff and orderlies and things like that, home health care aides, or they work in retail for a half or a third of what their parents made in factories.
This is KBOO Radio 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick talking to Howie Hawkins, who's an organizer in Syracuse, also a candidate for high office in New York. He's quite popular in New York and kept the Green Party on the ballot. Holly, you're organizing in a variety of ways. It seems to me your story is one that everybody could, it would be wonderful if we had somebody in every city or many people in every city doing what you're doing. You're organizing your neighborhood. You're organizing the city of Syracuse, not to win elections, at least not now, but really on a contending force. And you're also working on a state and national level as in the Green Party. Again, not winning elections, but keeping ideas alive, keeping critique alive. Just give us a sense of how you see that whole process over time.
Well, I've been advocating independent political action since the 1960s. I sort of asked the same question John Lewis asked at the March on Washington, where's my party? Because as I was coming up in the San Francisco Bay Area, the Republicans were campaigning against the fair housing law. This is 1964. Reagan's running around the state on his way to the governorship. And then the Mississippi Freedom Democrats tried to get recognized instead of the Dixiecrat segregationists, and they got turned back. And so, you know, I'm 12 years old saying, where's my party? What I became to understand was if our movements for good jobs and good conditions at work or for the environment, for social justice and the environment, if we don't have our own candidates running, the Democrats, who are the pseudo party of the common people, will take us for granted and move to the right, which they've been doing for my whole life. The kind of issues that used to be on a Democratic agenda when labor was stronger and civil rights movement was strong was things like the right to a job at a living wage guaranteed by the government through public works jobs and public service jobs. That has not been on the agenda of Congress since 1978 when Carter got the Humphrey Hawkins Full Employment Bill watered down so it really wasn't effective and didn't have a jobs program. So that's the thing. If we don't put up our own candidates, we're going to get taken for granted. If we don't act and speak for ourselves and try to practice what I call political ventriloquism, where you try to get the Democrats to say and do what you want, they'll give you us lip service, but they're getting money from the corporate interests to run their campaigns, and that's who they're really going to pay attention to. So that's been why, in addition to the movement work, I've run for office. And the state and national races have been to raise issues, build the party, you know, more educational campaigns. The local campaigns, I mean, in Syracuse, the Republicans have basically abandoned the field, and so the Greens are the opposition to the Democrats, who have every elected office in the city. So I ran for a district race in 2011 and got 48% of the vote. Now, you mentioned earlier how the Working Families Party was the margin of difference, and that year they were, and they caught us by surprise because they brought in organizers. I was the target of the whole organization. There weren't many contested elections in New York that year, and it seemed like the whole Democratic and Working Families Party apparatus came into my little inner city district and canvassed the hell out of the district the last week and squeaked out a victory for a guy that is backed by all the big developers. He's on the Economic Development Committee. He gives the tax breaks. And he's a social conservative as well. I mean, he's the only counselor that didn't vote for expanding the non-discrimination law in the city to transgenders. And he's proposed some housing issues that basically target students, discriminate against students, which if it gets passed, then it's a middle-class neighborhood that wants to keep rental housing out. But given the dynamics of the city, what it is a student residence registry and makes it hard for landlords to convert to student residences. So what they'll do is convert to Section 8, and then those middle-class people will be even more upset. But it's discriminatory. It's not fair housing. So he's a social as well as economic conservative, but the Working Families Party came in here in 2011, and this year we were expecting him, and we were much stronger in our canvas, and actually I got only 40% this time, which I kind of expected. There was no real mayoral race. We did put up a candidate late, but not somebody with much name recognition. The mayor refused to debate him, and as mayors across New York State did, except in New York City, where we did have a Green candidate who got in some of the debates, but Albany, Syracuse, Rochester, we had serious Green candidates and no debates. The media basically supported the establishment, which is the Democratic Party. You know, we did our canvass. I think we matched what Working Families and the Democrats did. So I don't think it made so much of a difference this year. It was just an incumbent, and their message to their voters was, he's done a good job, give him another chance. He's only been in there 2 years. And I'm going around saying the city's basically 18 months from fiscal insolvency, and we're going to be like Detroit, which on the doorsteps, you know, people said, really? And I'd explain it, and they'd say, wow, and they'd get worried. But they weren't even aware of that, and there was no mayoral race to, like, make it resonate. So we're calling for progressive tax reforms and restoring revenue sharing from the state, which is a big issue why we're going, and a lot of upstate cities and towns and school districts are headed for state takeover by financial control boards, similar to what happened in Detroit. Now, Detroit had fiscal mismanagement as well as the state cutting off revenue sharing. In most cases in New York, it's just the state has cut off the revenue sharing and forcing communities to rely on tax bases. And when you're in a city like Syracuse, where over half the taxes are off the rolls, mostly due to nonprofits, the university and hospitals, but also a lot of business giveaways. You know, they get tax exemptions for building shopping malls and stuff like that. We don't have the tax base to support basic city services. So that was the issue, and we had an incredible campaign. I had, 330 people contributed to my campaign financially, over 100 volunteered. We canvassed the hell out of the district. So overall vote was less than 20%. But in my district, it maintained because both sides talked to everybody. I mean, we did have a lot of voter contact. The problem was the issues weren't highlighted. And, you know, my take home from that was I was urged by municipal unions who did back me in the election and just a lot of people on the street and some of the Greens and some of the socialists in the city saying I should run for mayor to get the issues out there. But the Greens are so hungry for a victory, and I came so close last time, the majority sentiment was in the Green Party, run for this district race, you can win. I was skeptical. In fact, I predicted in the spring I'll probably get 40% given the dynamic of this being a first-time incumbent running for re-election and the mayor having a lot of money to throw his way. It wasn't just the Working Families Party. The mayor's campaign was out there canvassing the district long before Working Families Party came in here. But the Working Families Party position, their state upstate organizer said it'd be better to elect a right-wing Tea Party type candidate than to elect Howie Hawkins. And then he cited, you know, how I had disrupted a meeting on campaign finance reform. And I did. It was a sellout. They wouldn't let people speak from the floor. It was mobilization for a plan that would add a little bit of public matching funds on top of unlimited private campaign financing. That's a state bill. It didn't pass, but it's one of those things where the professional liberals go to the Democratic leadership and say, what are you willing to do? And then they go out and market it. And then if they get it, they call it a victory, even though it's really a defeat. Last year, we did get a raise in the minimum wage, but it goes to $8, then it goes to $8.75, then to $9 over the next 3 years. But the state is going to subsidize the difference between the old minimum wage and the new one for workers 18 to 21, but they won't pay that subsidy if you pay them a penny more than that minimum wage. So it's not just a floor, it's also a ceiling for those young workers and gives incentives to companies to fire people when they turn 21 and hire an 18-year-old. So, and they call that a victory. I see that as token and counterproductive. And what we really need is about $15 an hour, especially in a city like New York.
Fight for 15, Howie. Thanks a lot for talking to us. You're doing a great job there.
Well, my pleasure. Anytime.
You are tuned to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. I'm your host, Joe Clement. If you just tuned in, we were listening to Bill Resnick talking with Howie Hawkins about his class struggle experiences working in UPS and as a popular Green Party candidate in upstate but Democrat-controlled New York. Well, espousing a revolutionary mix of indigenous rights, feminism, anarchism, socialism, the Zapatistas have been in a declared war with the Mexican state since 1994. They are identify themselves as part of the ultra-globalization movement, as in struggle with neoliberalism. And Fran Michel will be bringing us the Well Read Red today that focuses on how this conflict is being remembered, fought, and supported today.
Good morning. This is Fran Michel here with today's Well Read Red on the Zapatista resistance to neoliberalism. I draw mostly from the blog post Four Things Feminists Can Learn from the Zapatistas by Juliana Brito Schwartz on the blog Feministing, but you can find this text with links to all full sources on my KBOO blog. This month marks the 20th anniversary of the Zapatista uprising in Mexico, a short moment with a long legacy of struggle for indigenous rights. The Zapatistas, also known as the Zapatista Army of National Liberation, or EZLN, are a movement of indigenous people fighting against the effects of neoliberalism, particularly the privatization of land and other natural resources. Named for Emiliano Zapata, a peasant leader of Mexico's 1910 revolution, the Zapatistas took control of several cities in Chiapas, one of Mexico's poorest states, with one of its biggest indigenous populations. Their movement first became public on January 1, 1994, the same day that the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, went into effect. The EZLN understood that NAFTA would increase the inequity between rich and poor and continue to direct the natural resources of Chiapas, their home state, out of the hands of the indigenous population and into the hands of the rich and powerful. The provisions of NAFTA would force Mexican farmers to compete with a wave of cheap U.S. imports, while under the terms of the agreement, the Mexican government had revoked their constitutional right to communal land. Globally, the increasing economic stagnation since the 1970s has prompted capital to respond with financialization, outsourcing and offshoring, and increasing pressure on workers and their organizations. Fred Magdoff and John Bellamy Foster, writing in the current issue of Monthly Review, note that various bilateral and multilateral trade agreements currently in effect or in development, from NAFTA to the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, are the result of a continuing process in which imperial capital has created a post-Second World War, post-colonial economic structure favorable to its interests. A report from Public Citizen on NAFTA at 20 points out that NAFTA differed from previous trade agreements and that it was only partially about trade. Among other provisions, NAFTA allowed foreign investors to directly challenge before foreign tribunals domestic policies and actions, demanding government compensation for policies that they claimed undermined their expected future profits. NAFTA also contained chapters that required the three countries to limit regulation of services such as trucking and banking, extend medicine patent monopolies, and limit food and safety product safety standards. The report summarizes its effects as 1 million U.S. jobs lost, mass displacement and instability in Mexico, record income inequality, scores of corporate attacks on environmental and health laws. Although the uprising in Chiapas began in response to the dangers posed by this neoliberal governance, some activists have criticized the Zapatistas for later withdrawing from direct confrontations with the state political power. Conflicts within the Mexican left arguably weakened resistance to neoliberal advances there, such as the recent privatization of Pemex, the state oil company. Still, most credit the Zapatista movement with important influence and accomplishments. In addition to achieving the continued self-government of reclaimed regions of Chiapas through forms of direct democracy, they have, as Duncan Tucker writes for Al Jazeera, also influenced numerous international protest movements, including Occupy Wall Street, Spain's Indignados, and Greece's Direct Democracy Now. At a time of widespread economic crisis and disillusionment with representative democracy, the rejection of capitalism and conventional party politics lies at the heart of their continued global appeal. Importantly, as Juliana notes on Feministing, in their continuing struggle for justice, the EZLN made a concerted effort to raise awareness about the status of indigenous women. In 1994, Comandante Ramona, one of the movement's most famous women leaders, created the Revolutionary Law on Women, which was voted into practice by the EZLN. The law made it clear that women had the right to reproductive autonomy, political participation equal to that of men, equal pay, education, and freedom from domestic violence. Later that year, the movement presented a list of 34 demands to the Mexican government, one of which outlined a series of actions to be taken to ensure the welfare of women. Here are a few things we can learn from this inspiring movement. Number one, there is another world. The Zapatistas took a look at the society they lived in, decided it wasn't working for them, and started a new way of living. They currently maintain various autonomous communities under their own systems of governance and their own independent schools. According to Gustavo Esteva at Upside Down World, they are, in fact, living outside the logic of the market and the state, beyond the logic of capital and within a new social fabric. This does not imply, of course, that they've escaped the capitalist social fabric that defines Mexico and the world, the unraveling of which, as the Zapatista Sixth Declaration states, requires weaving another social and political fabric. 2. You don't have to be powerful, privileged, or popular to change the world. In fact, real change often happens from the bottom up. The Zapatista movement sprang from some of the world's most marginalized people, yet their actions had a lasting impact on our world. 3. We must challenge systems of oppression even within our own social justice movements. As mentioned earlier, the EZLN is a feminist-leaning movement that has demonstrated that it's self-aware when it comes to the welfare of women. The movement has made several steps toward ensuring gender equity among its people, though gender equity is always a work in progress. Within any movement, we need to keep pushing each other forward while acknowledging successes on the road to justice. 4. The road to justice is long. The Zapatistas originally formed in response to the creation of NAFTA. They have now been around for over 20 years, and so has NAFTA. Indigenous activists have suffered greatly for this cause, but that does not mean that the struggle has not been worth it. The same is true for other movements for justice, in which we have to celebrate small victories on the road to success. But 20 years of indigenous resistance is certainly a big victory, and it must be celebrated. Bill Weinberg in Yes Magazine points out that spokesman Subcomandante Marcos says that the Zapatistas do not seek to seize power like traditional guerrillas, but instead pursue a revolution to make a revolution possible, opening a space for dialogue within civil society on how to reconceive the world. Marcos called on his army of moles to lay the groundwork for resistance throughout the planet. For the Old Mole Variety Hour, this has been Fran Michel.
You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. If you just tuned in, we were listening to Fran Michel bring us the Well Read Red. She was commenting on and giving us an overview of the struggle of the Zapatistas, which goes into its 20th year this month, as well as NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, which gave rise to not only the Zapatistas, but to eventually indigenous movements in other parts of the North American continent. And we may bring you content on them in the near future. Well, I've talked about the idea of a universal basic income on the show before, and even co-hosted a separate call-in program on the subject. Peter Frace, an editor of the socialist magazine Jacobin, was really the one who turned me on to the idea and co-hosted that program. Last May, he wrote an article, which I only just somehow discovered, that pushes these ideas even further and fleshes out how a basic income could fuel a communist project. Now that the Swiss are seriously considering a basic income, I'd like to read a long excerpt from the latter part of that article titled Curious Utopias. A link to the whole article will be posted with the audio of this reading. And I began a bit farther into the article than the very beginning. After discussing basic income in the news and various takes on the meaning of utopia, Frace turns to existential Marxist André Gorz. The French writer André Gorz was a longtime proponent of the basic income and is also responsible for a well-known theorization of its utopian transformative potential. In one of his early books, Strategy for Labor, he attempted to do away with the tired left debate over reform or revolution and replace it with a new distinction. And this is a long block quote. Is it possible from within, that is to say, without having previously destroyed capitalism, to impose anti-capitalist solutions which will not immediately be incorporated into and subordinated to the system? This question is the old question of reform or revolution. This was or is a paramount question when the movement had or has the choice between a struggle for reforms and armed resistance. Such is no longer the case in Western Europe. Here we no longer have an alternative. The question here revolves around the possibility of revolutionary reforms, that is to say, of reforms which advance toward a radical transformation of society. Is this possible? End quote. Gores goes on to distinguish reformist reforms, which subordinate themselves to the need to preserve the functioning of the existing system, from the radical alternative. It's another longer block quote. A non-reformist reform is determined not in terms of what it can be, but what it should be. And finally, it bases the possibility of attaining its objectives on the implementation of fundamental political and economic changes. These changes can be sudden, just as they can be gradual, but in any case, they assume a modification of the relations of power. They assume that the workers will take over powers or assert a force, that is to say, a non-institutionalized force, strong enough to establish, maintain, and expand those tendencies within the system which serve to weaken capitalism and to shake its joints. They assume structural reforms. End quote. One criticism of basic income is that it will not be systemically viable over the long run, as people increasingly drop out of paid labor and undermine the tax base that funds the basic income in the first place. But from another point of view, this prospect is precisely what makes a basic income a non-reformist reform. Thus, one can sketch out a more programmatic kind of utopianism that uses the basic income as its point of departure. One of my favorite gestures in this direction is Robert van der Veen and Philip von Parijs's 1986 essay, A Capitalist Road to Communism. The essay begins from the proposition that Marxism's ultimate end is not socialism, but rather a communist society that abolishes not merely exploitation, or the unjust distribution of the social product relative to work performed, but also alienation. Quote, productive activities need no longer be prompted by external rewards, end quote. They go on to sketch out a scenario in which a reform instituted under capitalism leads to communism without the intermediary stage of socialist construction. This thought experiment revolves around the achievement of an unconditional universal basic income. Suppose they say, quote, that it is possible to provide everyone with a universal grant sufficient to cover his or her fundamental needs without this involving the economy in a downward spiral. How does the economy evolve once such a universal grant is introduced? End quote. Their answer is that the basic income would twist the capitalist drive to increase productivity such that, here's another long block quote, the last I promise, entitlement to a substantial universal grant will simultaneously push up the wage rate for unattractive, unrewarding work, which no one is now forced to accept in order to survive, and bring down the average wage rate for attractive, intrinsically rewarding work. Because fundamental needs are now covered anyway, people can now choose to accept a high-quality job paid far below the guaranteed income level. Consequently, the capitalist logic of profit will, much more than previously, foster technical innovation and organizational change that improve the quality of work and thereby reduce the drudgery required per unit of product. End quote. Now, if you extrapolate this trend forward, you reach a situation where all wage labor is gradually eliminated. Undesirable work is fully automated as employers feel increasing pressure to automate because labor is no longer too cheap. Meanwhile, the wage for desirable work eventually falls to zero because people are both willing to do it for free and able to do so because the existence of a basic income to supply their essential needs. As André Gorz put it in a later book, The Critique of Economic Reason, certain activities may, quote, be partially repatriated into the sphere of autonomous activities and reduce the demand for these things to be provided by external services, whether public or commercial, end quote. The long-run trajectory, therefore, is one in which people come to depend less and less on the basic income because the things they want and need do not have to be purchased for with money. Some things can be produced costlessly and automatically as 3D printing and digital copying technologies evolve into something like Star Trek's replicator technology. Other things have become the product of voluntary cooperative labor rather than waged work. It therefore comes to pass that the tax base for the basic income is undermined, but rather than a crisis, as in the hands of basic income's critics, this becomes the path to utopia. Consider, for example, a basic income that was linked to the size of gross domestic product. We are used to a capitalist world in which the increase in material prosperity corresponds to a rise in GDP, the measured value of economic activity in money. But as wage labor comes to be replaced either by automation or voluntary activity, GDP would begin to fall and the basic income with it. This would not lead to a lower standard of living, though, because the falling GDP here also denotes a decline in the cost of living. Just like the socialist state and certain versions of traditional Marxism, the basic income withers away. As Van der Veen and Van Parijs put it, capitalist societies will smoothly move towards full communism. The capitalist road to communism is truly a utopia, not only in the colloquial sense of a total transformation of society, but also in its overly simplified and rationalistic picture of social evolution. As Frederick Jameson notes in his study of utopian politics and science fiction titled Archaeologies of the Future, utopias are defined as much by their closures and exclusions as by their positive programs, as much by what they cannot say as by what they can. A utopia often says more about the present in which it was written than it does about the future it depicts. In the case of the capitalist road to communism, the things left out include the political struggles that would ensue if social development threatened to evolve the capitalist class out of existence, gradually sapping their profits and social power. This began to manifest itself even under the meager basic income experiments in Namibia in the 1970s. White landlords were deeply hostile to the basic income and denied the evidence of its benefits, perhaps because they are, quote, afraid that the poor will gain some influence and deprive the rich white 20% of the population some of their power, end quote. Also brushed aside are the ecological limits that might make true abundance elusive. Both of these are themes that Peter Frese attempts to flesh out in his work Four Futures. A third issue, which he discussed a bit elsewhere, is the ingrained gender norms that may be reinforced by expanding the domain of quote-unquote voluntary labor, which often amounts to the imposition of unpaid work on women. But the conceptual clarity of Van der Veen and Van Parijs's rendition is enlightening in its very implausibility and incompleteness, a demonstration of the utopian impulse contained in an apparently timid policy proposal. If you just tuned in, I was reading the latter two-thirds of an article by Peter Frese, the editor of Jacobin Magazine, which is a revolutionary socialist magazine based out of New York. The title of this article was Curious Utopias. The link to the full article will be available when this reading and the whole show is posted in a day or two. 20 years ago, a trans man named Brandon Tina survived rape and escaped to tell about it, only to be murdered along with two other friends by the rapists. His story forms the basis for the 1999 film Boys Don't Cry. Denise Morris and Yasmin Nair will now talk about Brandon Tina, Matthew Shepard, and the hate crimes legislation that have emerged in response to their and other murders. They focus on the role economic, racial, and sexual inequalities play in so-called hate-based violence, especially when it comes to queer and trans folk, and how it may be missing from that hate crime legislation. Denise?
Thanks, Joe. Yes, I am here with Yasmin Nair this morning from cold, cold Chicago. Good morning, Yasmin. We're having a little bit of trouble with our connection. We do have Yasmin calling. We've called her in Chicago, and we know things are a little bit rough there, so we'll see about getting our connection back. This morning, we will talk about the Brandon Tina case, as it is 20 years ago this last December 31st, since that brutal murder in Humboldt, Nebraska. And Brandon's story had been told through documentary, crime novels, and the critically acclaimed film Boys Don't Cry. Critically acclaimed, but also somewhat... do we have her?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, great. Hey. Well, Let me just reset. I have Yasmin on the line. Yasmin Nayer, you're a Chicago-based writer and activist. We know it's very, very cold in Chicago, so we hope you're keeping warm.
And, yeah, thank you.
Yeah, we appreciate you joining us. You've been a longtime contributor to The Old Mole, but this particular subject of how we understand the role of hate crimes legislation and policing in our communities to keep our communities safe. Mm-hmm. We've not actually talked about that on this program. It's long overdue. I was reminding folks a little bit about the Brandon Tina case before we had you on the line. But let me just introduce you quickly so folks can know a little bit about your work, because Your work has appeared in The Progressive, Makeshift, Time Out Chicago. You've had blogs on The Balerico Project, Windy City Times, Bitch Magazine, No Potlucks. And most recently, you've been doing a lot in these times, which has been nice, including a piece that people might want to look up, which was a roundtable on the Orange is the New Black, the prison drama, the gay prison drama. So it fits in a little bit here. Anyway, you're also the co-founder of an important collective, Against Equality. We'll talk a little bit about the new publication from Against Equality, which is Prisons Will Not Protect You. I believe that's the title. Yes. So
sure.
So yeah, let me just round out this intro on what kind of brings us to talking about this morning. Again, Brandon Tina's murder was 20 years ago this last December 31st, so just this last week. And as I was saying, the story has really been told much through documentary, crime novels, and the film Boys Don't Cry. Mm-hmm. This was a murder of a 21-year-old who was described as a transgendered man, although unfortunately Brandon didn't really have an opportunity to speak for himself. He was living as a man and seemed to be wanting to make certain changes in his life, although we can only speculate on some of that. But was definitely targeted for his life, way he was living his life. As well, so this happened in 1993. As well, in 1998, both James Byrd Jr. and Matthew Shepard were brutally murdered in Texas and Wyoming, respectively. And these high-profile cases really did further increase the demands for hate crimes law. And in 2009... nearly 15 years after the Brandon Tina murder and more than 10 after the Byrd and Shepard murders, the United States passed the federal Matthew Shepard and James Byrd Jr. Hate Crimes Prevention Act. And Yasmin, you have written extensively over the years about hate crimes law, their limitations and as prevention of bias crimes, and the consequences for marginalized communities as a result of this what becomes increased police presence and surveillance in our communities, particularly marginalized communities, and the enhanced sentencing, which further bulks up the prison industrial complex. So lots of people are really invested in hate crimes law as a path toward creating safer communities. But this morning we wanted to kind of sort that out a bit. So could you start by just talking about hate crimes law and how it fits into the picture for gay, trans, and queer people?
Mm-hmm, sure. Well, and in fact, the Hate Crime Prevention Act, was actually named, as you rightly pointed out, for a gay white man and an African-American man who, as far as we know, was straight. What's, of course, interesting is that it is still referred to constantly as the Matthew Shepard Law. And I think that speaks to one of the trajectories, in terms of historical trajectories, of this particular act, which was the way it became part and parcel of the mainstream gay community, really pushing for the advancement of a particularly punitive system, which supposedly grants more protection. So that's really what it's embedded in. Is this, the hate crimes legislation has a long and complicated history. Actually, it actually came about for what was at the time particularly logical reasons. It was simply the case that in the 50s and 60s, for instance, there were simply no prosecutions for those who were attacked on grounds, in particular, of race. right? So the hate crimes legislation was actually proposed as a way to counteract that. And then over the years, given the United States investment in the prison industrial complex and its punitive systems in general, it just became a way to actually police and surveil particularly marginalized communities. And in the 1990s and the 2000s, the gay community, which is to say the mainstream gay community, charged full force into this, demanding an expansion of hate crimes laws to include sexual orientation and so on. So that's sort of, and so there's a long sort of complicated shambling history around hate crimes legislation. And essentially what it says is that it protects people by enacting greater punishment on their behalf. The idea, the rather misguided idea being that it somehow punishing people more by, for instance, expanding sentences to, say, from 5 years to 20 to 30 years, or even in many cases actually seeking the death penalty, that somehow serves as a deterrent. So deterrent is one of the primary sort of contentions at the heart of hate crimes legislation. The idea that somehow, you know, it's like the nailing the coyote to the wall kind of image, right? That if you somehow make evidence of punishment evident, visible to others, people will not do as much, will not commit as many crimes. And of course, as we know historically, in reality, this is simply not how that works. Hate crimes legislation has not resulted in a dip in any kind of crimes against, particularly against minority communities, for instance. What it also does not do is address the systemic issues, and this is where people like me come from, is that the issues related to people who especially are on the margins, say, for instance, trans sex workers or people of color who are, quote-unquote, caught loitering in Chicago's tonier gay neighborhoods and so on, those people are actually, in fact, the ones most likely to be charged under hate crimes legislation. And the statistics on that are kind of slow and are mostly, at this point, are relatively anecdotal. But we know for a fact, for instance, that in Chicago is Boys Town. I live in Chicago on the north side, and in the Boys Town area, which has been the site of a lot of racial harassment of young black youth in particular, the idea has been that the crimes are committed by young black queer youth simply because they're young black queer and quote-unquote desperate. So in that sense, the logic of hate crimes legislation is actually being used to bear upon an extremely marginalized community. In Chicago, we have very few resources for queer youth, and those who live on the south and west sides have to make the trek up to the north side, for instance. So they're compelled to come to the north side, where they're instantly surveilled. So there's a way in which hate crimes legislation, the idea of hate crimes, fits into this kind of surveillance of quote-unquote minority communities, and especially communities at risk. There are just so many problems with hate crimes legislation, and of course, the inevitable result of slapping on a hate crime charge to any kind of sentence is that it increases the sentence, it can even bring upon the threat or the reality of a death sentence, and it simply fortifies the prison industrial complex. What all of this means in terms of the gay community in particular is that a certain group of mainstream gays are able to exert, they are able to use the force of the state to keep themselves, quote-unquote, safe from imagined or real, or perhaps sometimes even real, assailants. And they're able to invoke the power of the state, essentially, to border, as we see in Chicago, to essentially police the borders of literally their property, their assets, and so on. That's where it comes down to in terms of hate crimes legislation. And there are further complications around class issues, and I think the Brandon Tina case in particular is really important to bring up at this point because, as many have pointed out, there are all these very complicated issues around class which got erased in the more popular narrative, particularly the narrative, as we know, promulgated by the film, went on to become an Oscar award-winning film and so on. But that narrative of class vulnerability, which is to say what happens to a young person or any person of any age who is redefining their sexual and gender identity, right, not with the resources available to, say, for instance, a scion of the Pritzker family. One of the Pritzkers in Chicago is, besides being a very conservative pro-military person, has just come out as trans. Now, that person has a lot of resources available, has the kind of visibility that protects them, you know, the kind of neoliberal discourse or an identity that protects them, whereas someone like Brandon Tina is far more vulnerable in being targeted for their refusal or their inability, whatever it might be, to conform to certain gender expectations. That also brings about certain other complications, which is to say, I don't want to reinforce the idea that people of a quote-unquote lower class background are somehow inherently transphobic. And that's also, I think, what is so troubling about the Brandon Tina narrative, not so much the facts themselves, but what's so troubling about the Brandon Tina narrative is the way in which it actually reinforces this kind of stereotype about class backgrounds, right, about white trash in particular, quote unquote, right, at the same time that it does not actually address the profound vulnerabilities brought upon someone who cannot afford, right, to quote unquote pass well, quote unquote, who may not want to, for instance, pass, who may want to maintain a certain level of instability and to refuse kind of conform to stereotypes. Right. So I think the Brandon Tina is, and then Matthew Shepard, of course, is an interesting case in itself because we have Matthew Shepard, whose parents are relatively wealthy, Matthew Shepard came from a rather privileged background. There's a new book about him, right, which talks about those class issues.
And Yasmin, we're going to have to end here at 58 to the hour. So I just wanted to let folks know that we will be able to continue this conversation through the webpage. We'll post, there's quite a lot of writing to be mined on this subject, and including your own and some books and a couple of very important, I think, long articles that people can access to get more information and more of a nuanced look at the question of hate crimes legislation. And I wanted to thank you for joining us this morning on the Old Mole Variety
Hour.
Thank
you, as always.
Yeah, and I've been talking with Yasmin Nayer, Chicago-based writer and activist, about hate crimes legislation and hopefully alternatives to that, to policing. Thank you again.
Thanks. Bye.
Well, that's all the time we have for today's Old Mole Variety Hour. I've been your host, Joe Clement. Thanks to Bill Resnick and Howie Hawkins for sharing class struggle experiences at UPS and in other contexts. To Fran Michel for her well-read read about the Zapatistas. To Peter Frace for championing what Ernst Bloch called the warm streams of utopia in his essay about basic income and the capitalist road to communism. And to Denise Morris and Yasmin Nayer for discussing hate crimes legislation in the context of economic, racial, and social inequalities. You can find us on the web in a day or two by going to kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. There you can find the whole show, individual segments, and many links to things and people we mention. You can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter by looking up the Old Mole Variety Hour, or email us with comments, questions, or suggestions at oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com. Tune in next week for more news, reviews, interviews, and analysis from the Mole's radical underground perspective. I've been your host, Joe Clement, and we'd be remiss if we did not mention that this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Clinton Street Theater, featuring independent and revival films, the Rocky Horror Picture Show every Saturday at midnight, as well as the monthly KBOO Movie Night. The Clinton Street Theater is located at the corner of Southeast Clinton and 26th in Portland. Schedule and information at 503-238-5588 or cstpdx.com.
And good morning. It's 10 a.m. You are tuned to KBOO in Portland. And coming right up will be Air Cascadia with Chris Andre. That will be followed at 10:15 by Locus Focus, when host Barbara Bernstein speaks with environmental writer Andrew Nikiforuk about how the Cochin Pipeline Project reveals the connections between fracking for natural gas in the United States and booming tar sands development in Alberta. At 11 on Health Watch, host Dr. David Naiman interviews Dr. Joel Fuhrman about superimmunity and why some of us get sick with greater frequency than others. And at 11:30 on Madness Radio, the guest is David Edward Walker, who talks about how the legacy of colonialism impacts American Indian mental health today. So do stay tuned for all of that, and thank you, KABU members, for your support in 2013. We appreciate your membership to help KABU stay strong.
Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Monday, January 6th, 2014, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, kboo.fm on the web. First, a few headlines. As always seems to be the case, we are trying to get in touch with a very, very busy woman, Kshama Svant, the socialist member of Seattle's city council, whose candidacy stirred national debate about the minimum wage and what constitutes a living wage. A very busy person. And that's a good thing for all of us as we consider this is the 100th anniversary of the 40-hour work week. Many people who are staunch Republicans, staunch conservatives, even Tea Party members, who are working 40-hour weeks, have very liberal socialist, in fact, people of great courage who fought hard and in some cases gave their lives all in the name of the workers' protection from abuses of their employers. Something to bear in mind as debate begins to heat up over the coming 2016 elections. But first, the headlines. The City Council just might allocate oversight of the Water Bureau and Bureau of Environmental Services to the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon. Will that have any impact? That all depends on exactly whose pocket that institution, the Bureau of Environmental Services, the Citizens Utility Board, is actually in, who they, in fact, are beholden to. And credit reports were originally developed to assist financial creditors in considering